Clay Shirky popularized the phrase, "The Internet runs on love." He should know. Shirky writes about the net and new technologies for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and teaches at New York University's Interactive Telecommunications Program. "Here Comes Everybody" is the title of his latest book. Shirky told Steve Paulson that the networking potential of the net is immense and surprising. Just look at the story of a New York woman's missing cell phone.
This happened in May of 2006. A woman named Ivana lost her cell phone in the back of a cab. It was a fairly expensive phone, a Sidekick, which had a screen and a camera and so on. It also had, unfortunately for her, all the details of her wedding, which was coming up in a few days, and she had caterers' details, guest lists, and so forth on it. So she went to a friend of hers, Evan Gutman, who at the time worked in the financial industry, and said, "Send an email to the phone saying reward if found." Well, they sent the email. Nothing happens. A couple days later, she buys a new phone. And her phone company says, "Oh, you know, we've got all the data on our servers as well. We've cached a copy. Do you want us to put it on your new phone?" She said, "Yes, absolutely." So she gets all the data on the new phone. And not only does she now have her address book back, she also has the face and email address of the woman who now has the phone, who's a 16-year-old living in Queens. And so they have her email address, they have her photo. They're very quickly able to find her MySpace page on the social networking site she frequents. And they begin communicating with her directly. And Sasha, that was this girl's name, refused to give the phone back on the age-old logic of finders keepers. And this so enraged Evan and Ivana that they started documenting everything about the attempt to get the cell phone back. And Evan put it up on his site, evanwashere.com. It's under the heading Stolen Sidekick. And it caught people's eye. It ended up on the front page of Dig, which is a social news service. And unbeknownst to Sasha, even as they were negotiating with this 16-year-old to get this phone back, first thousands, then tens of thousands, and ultimately millions of people were tuning in worldwide to watch this thing unfold. It made the front page of the New York Times, it made CNN, and so forth.
And meanwhile, there were also threats. Sasha's brother and her boyfriend were telling Evan, "Lay off or else."
Right. I mean, rather remarkably, Sasha, as you say, Sasha's boyfriend and her brother, who at least claimed to be in the military police, weren't just saying she's not going to give the phone back. They were actually threatening at various points either physical violence or a lawsuit for harassment, even though they clearly had stolen property in their possession. And this actually served only further to enrage Evan and Ivana. And so there was this kind of war of words building up. And as I said in the book, right, what from Sasha's side, all of the threats and attempts to get the, you know, keep the phone had this kind of you and what army quality about them, because they were thought they were just negotiating with some, you know, person in Manhattan who really didn't have a lot of support and who really wasn't going to spend a lot of time or energy getting back a $300 phone. And they were so wrong. They were so spectacularly wrong. Evan did have an army of sorts. He didn't just get an audience, right? He got people offering him legal advice. He got people videotaping the house for him. He got people offering to explain to him. Actually, a New York City cop explained to him how to get the phone reclassified from lost merchandise, about which the New York Police Department would do nothing, to stolen merchandise. And when he finally did that, lo and behold, the cops went out to the house, they recovered the phone, they arrested Sasha. And it really, that event couldn't have happened even a couple years before. What Evan, as a private citizen, was able to avail himself of was both a media platform and a collaborative set of tools that simply haven't been in the hands of ordinary citizens and now are.
It's an amazing story. I guess I wonder if this is just a remarkably unusual story, that something like this just took off, or are we seeing more of this?
That story is unusual in that the next time someone loses a phone, it doesn't get nearly the attention. In fact, there's a famous case in Canada of a car being stolen, and a community of really a vintage car appreciators came around and helped recover it, but it didn't make the international press anymore. So there is a kind of unique quality about that particular story. What's not, I think, unique is the idea that ordinary citizens can now participate in the media environment, and that participation is different than them just behaving like tiny professional media outlets. You get novel kinds of effects, like the recovery of this phone, once media is really something that we all participate in rather than something that we all just consume and only a small professional class participates in.
And this also extends to journalism itself. I mean, it's no longer just
Absolutely.
A matter of reading the New York Times or watching your local TV news. I mean, people, average people out there can be journalists. If they start their own blogs, they can actually report stuff and in some cases break big stories.
Absolutely. One of my favorite examples from this is Alisar Chirapongse, who blogs. She's a Thai fashion student living in Bangkok and blogs under the name Gnarly Kitty. And she just blogged about her life. It was all shoes and going out to the clubs and so forth and so on. And then one day she wakes up and there's a coup in Thailand. So she gets her camera and she goes out. And she is one of the first people to upload pictures of tanks in front of the parliament building. Now, when the coup happened, the military in Thailand shut down the traditional press, but they didn't shut down the blogosphere. And so Chirapongse became one of the primary sources for photographic evidence of what was going on inside the country, not because she was a trained journalist, but because she had access to both the means of production, the camera, and the means of distribution, her weblog. When ordinary citizens can generate the kind of media that makes the ruling party look unfavorable, it is a much harder thing to deal with than just trying to figure out how do we shut down traditional media. These people aren't journalists, right? They're just committing acts of journalism. And there's a great post in Chirapongse's blog a few days later where she started talking about a Hello Kitty phone she liked. And then people were complaining like, no, forget the phones. We're not interested in the phones. Get back to the coup. And she has this wonderful post where she says, look, this blog is about me and my life. One of the things that happened in my life is there was a coup in my country. But another thing that's happening in my life is I really like this Hello Kitty phone. And if you don't like it, get out. I'm not here for you. And that I think illustrates the difference between professional journalists defined as a category by membership versus acts of journalism, where sometimes people are documenting a coup and sometimes they're documenting a Hello Kitty phone, and they don't actually make a big distinction between those two activities.
Now, why is all this taking off so much right now? Is it tapping into the inherent social nature of human beings that we want to interact with other people?
Yeah, that's absolutely it. The technology is only an enabler. And in fact, one of the things I say in the book is this stuff doesn't get socially interesting until it gets technologically boring. There are almost no stories in the book that use anything other than the most rudimentary technology, right? There's an email list over here, some people doing IM over there, there's a website. It's really all stuff that was pretty much perfected in the 90s. The big shift now isn't technological achievement, it's social density, right? It's the fact that in industrialized societies, a majority of the population now doesn't just have access to these tools, but uses them and is completely comfortable with them. And because of that, right, for instance, in the presidential campaign we're seeing right now, the use of the internet as a fundraising tool, as a campaigning tool, as a propaganda tool, and so forth, is not only taking off by leaps and bounds, it's very often being advanced by the users. Particularly for Obama, many of the most successful Obama videos, whether it's Obama Girl or Will I Am or the recent young Hillary Clinton video, are not produced by the campaign nor are they distributed by the campaign. And that changed, right? We've been stuck in the 20th century with an only consume model of media, right? Someone beams something at you, and if you have any reaction, it's spluttering over at breakfast to your wife about how stupid the editorial is or what have you, or yelling back at the radio or the TV. But now we've got a media environment where people can consume, but we can also produce and we can share. And because we like to do those things, technology that enables those things is now leading to this enormous amount of experimentation with new forms of media that are involving the audience rather than just treating them passively.
Now, there's obviously something very exciting about all of this. I mean, there's a democratic nature to bringing in lots of people and not just the so-called experts. But there is some value in having gatekeepers out there. I mean, without them, you get a lot of yelling, you get racist comments, you get people getting trashed. I mean, should we worry about this?
You know, I don't think we should worry about the fact of those things. They happened before. What I think we should worry about is not having an environment where that's all there is, right? You need both civil and uncivil discourse on the internet, just as you need both civil and uncivil discourse really in any part of society. And so some places, when you go there, if you go to some open forums on the internet, right, you will find exactly this kind of racist ranting. Ken Lane has just written a wonderful thing about the just the incredible racism and misogyny that comes out in the comments about anything having to do with either Obama or Hillary's campaign. And it seems almost spring-loaded. What Lane says is basically, no matter what article I write, I know you stupid people are going to come in and make these kind of comments. But then you go to places like Boing Boing, which is a human-moderated conversational network, right? The Boing Boing weblog, very highly trafficked, has a person look over every comment by an anonymous user before posting it. And so that is a very civil and informative environment. Certainly, if I had to pick between those two models, I'd go for the civility. But I'd much rather have both of them working side by side, because in some cases there are places where pure freedom of speech is a bracing tonic. And then in other places, you absolutely want the kind of degree of control that lets people actually hear each other talk. And we're still in a really experimental phase with all this. That, I think, is one of the remarkable things going on, is that all of this energy is going off in all directions trying to figure out how do we harness the social value of this new environment.
Clay Shirky is an internet expert and the author of the book Here Comes Everybody. Steve Paulson spoke with him.